Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today may be responsible for what you're reading. As the literary editor of the Sunday Times, he plays a major role in shaping the public perception of recently published works. A good review sells books, and rankings in the paper's weekly charts matter hugely to publishers, authors, and, of course, many readers. Andrew Holgate, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you very much, Georgina.
Andrew, so being the literary editor of a major newspaper isn't exactly like being a fireman or a ballet dancer. It's not the usual ambition for a child. And I wonder what your first ambitions were.
I always wanted to be have something to do with books. I had a slightly lonely childhood, which is traditional of people who are connected with books. And I read a lot when I was a very young teenager, lots of black classics and things. I think besides footballer or rugby player, I think it was always something to do with books. I did want to be in publishing. I tried publishing. It didn't quite work out. But yeah, I'm very happy where I am. And I'm aware as well that I'm very lucky and that this is a job that lots and lots of people would like to have.
Yeah, well, tell us, walk us through your day.
Every week is the same. Bizarrely, for a Sunday paper, we go to press on Wednesday. So I come in on Monday morning and have the pages will have already been laid out the previous week. And just lots of editing on Monday and Tuesday. One of the things that is hardest as an editor to learn to do is to be tough enough to send stuff back and say, I think this needs some work. And that takes some time for you to gain the confidence to do that, because you're dealing with quite serious writers a lot of the time, who are much more distinguished than anything you could ever possibly imagine yourself to be. And so learning to have the courage to do that takes some time. So there's a lot of that on Monday and Tuesday. Wednesday we go to press. Every week we have a conference where I present the list to the rest of the newspaper about what's coming up and is up for discussion. Thursday and Friday we do design. So I'm involved at every single stage. So picking the pictures, overseeing the design, each has a different day. And then I have to try and read the books as well, or read some of the books in between that. Commission ahead. I mean, it's quite busy.
I can imagine. Yeah. I mean, I probably receive anywhere between 30 and 60 books a week, depending on the time of year. And I imagine that it's much, much bigger
for you. We get slightly insane amounts. Christmas is not much, but in the peak seasons, which tend to be April and May and September and October, we'll get at least 250 or 300, sometimes 400 books a week. And you have to sift through that. And in a way, I am one of the least well-read people connected with books, because I read a lot of beginnings of books and I don't actually, bizarrely, have that much time to get all the way to the end of a lot of books. Mm. We have 11 slots a week. When you're trying to boil it down from 250, say, to 11, you just develop these shorthands, really, about what you choose. It's partly to do with the balance of the pages. It's partly to do with the reputation of the author. It's partly to do with the interest of the subject matter. Stupid things like which publishing imprint it comes from, because part of my job is to get to know the editors as well and learn who to trust and who I think are good. So there are lots of shorthands you use. Mm.
And so in terms of an opener, if you're just going to read, say, the first five pages of a book, what is it that's going to absolutely turn you off?
It depends between a novel and a piece of nonfiction. There is more latitude with a piece of nonfiction, to be completely honest. But with fiction, I think I am the harshest, nastiest critic around, because sometimes I will put a book down after a paragraph. Sometimes you can actually tell some things even from the first sentence. You know, it sounds horrific, but if a first sentence is poorly constructed or has a poor use of adjective or an over-eager use of adjective in the first sentence, you're immediately on alert and thinking, And it's terrible. But you have to be that cruel as a literary editor, because fiction, we have four books a week. We now have a system whereby we do quite a lot of roundups to try and get more books in. But really, we don't have a lot of latitude.
I wonder then how much scope there is for debut authors.
There's quite a lot. Part of my job is to scout what is new and what is fresh. Publishers will also spend a disproportionate amount of their energy trying to promote new writers, particularly in the first half of the year. It's traditional. The first few months is when new writers are broken. And so you're given quite a lot of help by publishers who they consider. You have to accept some advice from publishers. Obviously, they are there just to sell to you, so you have to take things with a pinch of salt. But they do get a pretty fair crack of the whip, I think, new writers. But it is very hard. And one thing I feel particularly proud of is our paper's ability to spot new talent and really to get behind new people when we can and try and make a difference, because I know that our paper can make a huge difference to sales. There's this thing I have on Sunday. Amazon have a bestseller list and each book has a bestseller ranking. And on Saturday night before the paper comes out, I will often write down the ranking before the paper appears and then see on Sunday night what the ranking is after that. And often a review in our paper, if we're the only review, will have made a significant difference to the Amazon ranking.
So that's a huge responsibility. I mean, you can make or break a book.
No, I wouldn't say that much. No, I don't think. I think those days for literary newspapers are in the past. But I think we and perhaps The Guardian still have an ability to influence, is how I'd put it, and to help. I don't think a bad review from the Sunday Times necessarily does any harm to a book. Certainly, we've given a lot of bad reviews to books that have gone straight into the bestseller list. But I think we can, if we do it right, really help new books. So, for instance, there's a memoir by a woman called Tara Westover called Educated, which is coming out this month. It's about how she survived a survivalist upbringing in Idaho, in the wilds of Idaho, and went to Cambridge, didn't walk into a classroom until the age of 17. 10 years later, she got a PhD from Cambridge. It's an extraordinary story. I was very excited about it. We have rather naughtily gone a bit early, but I think us having signposted that book will make a significant difference to it, how people view it. So that's very exciting. And I love that part of the job. I absolutely love that part of the job.
And in terms of bad reviews, I mean, you must have a personal relationship, as you say, with publishers, but also with the authors themselves. It must be quite difficult if they're going to trash their book.
Now I tend not to go to publisher parties very much. My job is not to be friends with authors. And that's one of the most difficult things, is that I really try not to have a relationship with authors. I don't go to their parties. Quite often publishers will ask you to dinners in advance. I never do that. You just can't do it because it skews everything. So I have, in a way, a rather boring backseat role away from the sort of literary highlights. But that's the way it has to be, really.
And in terms of the actual reviews themselves, obviously you can't write them all yourselves and you do commission, as you say, some very well-known people to do that. How about matching the book with the reviewer? How does that work?
It's partly expertise. We have a lot of generalists who write for us. I think if you have too many experts on particular subjects, they can be quite dry. We are proudly generalist. We appeal to the general reader, that is our audience, and so we have to make sure everything works in that way. But there are some obvious things like 19th century history. There are certain people who will do that, but we tend to have reviewers for history books who are more generalist, are very good on history over long periods. Fiction is difficult. We have about four or five very, very good frontline reviewers, and it's a question of tastes. If someone has had a very bad experience with a well-known author, I will probably not give them their next book because it doesn't seem right. Mm. I think you need a fresh voice and a fresh look at that. So it's a variety of things come into play.
How does your ranking work, your lists?
So that is not really in our purview. It's done by an independent company called Nielsen, you know, who do a lot of listings for all over the world for all sorts of things. They take the numbers from bookshops every week and all sorts of retail outlets, and they simply collate it for us. There are occasionally issues about whether a book is a general nonfiction book or a manual, but it has extraordinary influence, and we do get a lot of publishers interested in that and a lot of publishers emailing me about that, about why their books might be classified as one thing or another. So that creates its own pressure as well. Mm. They are the most influential in the book business. So that's quite a responsibility as well.
Another big influential part of your job is the couple of prizes that you run.
Yes, so we have two. We have the Sunday Times EFG Short Story Award, which is now in its ninth year. We've just announced the long list for the 2018 award. And we also have the reanimated Sunday Times Peters Fraser and Dunlop Young Writer of the Year Award. in association with Warwick University, which has got an extraordinary list of past winners. So everyone from Zadie Smith, Sarah Waters, Robert McFarlane, Adam Folds, William Dalrymple, extraordinary list. It had a very good ability to pick people when they're young who then go on to be future greats. We had to stop that one after the 2008 crash, but thanks from Caroline Michel at Peter Fraser and Dunlop, we've reanimated that. And I'm terrifically excited by that in particular as a way of finding new talent.
I spoke to many of those writers from the last prize, including the winner, Sally Rooney.
Sally Rooney, yeah,
who has
wonderful book.
Such a great, but maybe you could just tell us a little bit about her work.
Well, it's a first novel. She's only 26, you know, she's an Irish writer. And the book is just a wonderful book about a relationship between two young, 22, 23-year-old, precocious wannabe writers. They're performance poets, I think. And then some rather more sophisticated couple that they meet. One is an online journalist and one is a slightly faded actor. And it's about the relationship between the four of them. And it's both very winning and readable, but very intelligent and knowing. And I interviewed her, interestingly, last November before the prize was announced. And she said that when she'd written it, because it appears quite light, but it is very sophisticated, she realised after she had written it that essentially she'd rewritten Emma for the modern age. And I think that's absolutely right. And it's wonderful. She's an immense talent.
She's a huge talent. Yeah. And I was talking to her about sort of where she thought she fitted in the canon of,
oh, that's
of Irish
what did she
literature.
Say?
Well, I think like most Irish writers, she's really anxious to say, please, please don't compare me to Joyce.
Yes, completely. There's barely a shred. And I think there is that reaction to that Joycean tradition going on in Irish writing, particularly in young Irish writing, I think. Although it's interesting for the Short Story Awards this year, there were quite a number of Irish stories that had very Joycean elements to them. Either one in particular from Ulysses, which was felt like a retread of the monologue at the end of Ulysses, a slightly ironic retread of it. I think it must be very hard for Irish writers to get away from that, because you have the two extremes. You have the short stories, the Dubliners, which is one tradition, and then you have Ulysses, which is the other, and both immensely influential.
Do you see nationalist tropes going through writing from different countries?
To a degree, yes. One thing that's exercising me at the moment, and certainly exercises the judges for the Short Story Award every year, are the traditions that are expressed within the short story of different countries. And some of that is to do with the teaching of the short story. So, for instance, there is a form of American self-revelatory short story that is very much taught in the Idaho School of Writing. And you can pick that almost straight away. But they're very controlled, but very, very American. And you can, and there are dozens and dozens of them that come out every year. More exuberance from the Irish, which might be a cliche. There is definitely something very exciting going on in Irish, young Irish writing at the moment, partly through the aegis of Stinging Fly, the monthly magazine, which has had a huge influence on young Irish writing. And actually, Sally Rooney has just become the editorial director or the literary editor. I don't know what her title is, but the main editor of Stinging Fly, which I think is very exciting. Mm.
Well, that's an interesting topic, is this whole resurgence, really, we're seeing of the literary magazine.
So there's White Review. I mean, I can't think of that many of them, but there's a lot, obviously, now online. So going back to what we were talking about earlier about the declining influence of newspapers in terms of fixing the debate, there is much more online. Although about 10 years ago, there were lots of literary bloggers. I'm sure you read a lot of them, as I did. That seems to have declined, bizarrely, and I don't quite know why that is. But I'm less aware of literary magazines than possibly I should be. I mean, the New Yorker has a huge influence with its short stories. There is a debate going on within newspapers and within the wider media about trustworthiness. And I think in a very small arena of the literary world, I think we fit into that debate. A lot of online reviews and opinion does not carry the stamp of trustworthiness. Below the line, recommendations on certain websites. There have been all sorts of scandals about people writing reviews about themselves or trashing other people under pseudonyms. And so I think that does give a duty to literary newspapers to be as honest as they can. So the very first question after, would you like to write a review of this book, I always ask every single reviewer is, do you know this author? And if they know the author, then I can't use them. Mm. That ethos has to apply to everything we do. We stand or fall as literary pages on readers' ability to trust our judgment and trust our reviewers.
Mm.
So it's an interesting issue. And I think, I hope that the way that the debate about trustworthiness in the media is going is to the benefit of newspapers.
Do you do much on books in translation?
We do. The Independent, before they stopped printing, were very good. Boyd Tonkin, the literary editor there, they made a feature of it. Since they've stopped, we have upped our foreign fiction coverage. And we have an individual reviewer, David Mills, who's excellent, who covers that now in a very forthright way. So yes, we have significantly increased that in the last 2 years, and I'm very proud of that as well. And it feels very important. In terms of readership, I'm not sure the breadth of the readership for it, but I think it is very important to reflect that in the pages.
Is there any room for snobbery in reading?
It's one of the abiding vices of the literary world. It's snobbery is absolutely everywhere. And I realise that I'm a snob as well a lot of the time. I sometimes stop myself and say, hold on, why are we doing this? And you realise the prejudices you have. We have to try very hard not to be snobby. We are a very small industry appealing to a quite narrow band of readers. You know, there are over 50% of the country don't read books. Our mission should be about trying to make books as interesting as possible to as many people as possible. Our chief literary reviewer is John Carey, Merton Professor of English at Oxford, emeritus now. His ethos has very much affected our pages, which is that there is nothing that can't be explained to a general reader in an accessible and interesting way. And he has made it his duty to do that, down to the fact that he will take out semicolons from any of his reviews that he can find. He'll take out commas if he thinks it interrupts the flow of his piece. And we very much follow that ethos. I think it's our duty to try and make our pages as accessible as possible. Mm. Some people don't do that. There are some writers who glory in inaccessible language. They can do that, but I don't think it's admirable at all.
Talking about this sort of push to get people reading, what do you think could be done? Should it be a government initiative?
That I don't know. I don't think you can force these things. You know, we are competing in a marketplace, and the marketplace is dominated by television now. We have gone from 100 years ago to being the primary artistic form to being very much a secondary or tertiary form. I don't think government intervention, I can't see how that would work, really. What's interesting about fiction at the moment is that there is a debate within literature about the box set versus the literary novel. And there are editors who've talked to me who have said novelists have to learn from the narrative art that is displayed in the box set, and they have to start adapting. And that is very interesting, that literature is beginning to adapt itself to the pressures of another art form. So I suspect, literature is pretty resilient, and I think it will adapt, and it is adapting, but I don't think it can be government.
It's interesting talking about that sort of television crossover. I find that I'm reading a lot of books now that I feel that the author has clearly written this with the aim of it being filmed.
That's interesting. There's a lot of that, I think. A lot from some quite well-known writers as well who are clearly doing that. Yes. I just was reading a book yesterday. The opening is clearly such a dramatic, televisual and very visual opening.
So what makes a bestseller?
Pass. If I knew that, I wouldn't be doing my job.
No, but I mean, you see books that one thinks possibly have very little literary merit, and yet they are selling millions.
Well, I think bestseller does not equate with quality necessarily, and that's fine, and that always has been the case. What makes a literary bestseller is a different kettle of fish. What I've come to realise is how much a publisher's can influence books becoming bestsellers. There's a couple of books recently that I read. I couldn't see how they would become bestsellers. But sheer will from the publishers have made them bestsellers. There is a type of literary book, which is a reading group book, which is well-written, not challenging, intellectually reasonably stimulating without being terrifying, so that both flatters the reader and entertains them. And I think there is a type of book like that with a hook of a subject that will do very well.
Mm.
I think a lot of publishers spend a lot of time looking for those books.
But by the time something becomes the thing, the moment's passed. You can't...
Although, because publishing is not a science, there is a lot of copycatting that goes on. So, for instance, Sarah Perry's The Essex Serpent, huge literary bestseller last year or the year before. We are now going to have endless books like that, Victorian books about serpents or mysterious animals with freewheeling heroines. So once someone finds something, everyone piles in until the seam runs dry.
Andrew, finally, your own reading. Firstly, electronic or physical book?
Always physical. I tried electronic. I just couldn't do it.
And in terms of having a system for getting through books or even parts of books fast, do you have one?
No. I'm actually a very slow reader, which is a real problem for me. But I find that if I pay a lot of attention in the first 60 pages, 50 or 60 pages, and then quicken up, I will get the gist. You have to pay very close attention early on, even for speed reading.
And can you read purely for pleasure now?
Only old books. In fact, I've got a week's holiday coming up, and I'm so looking forward to some reading for pleasure.
What will you read?
I've never read The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. It's very short, which is perfect for me. So I'm actually going to Venice, which has nothing to do with Jean Brodie at all. But I'm going to take that with me and a couple of other books. I'm looking forward to that.
Andrew Holgate, who's the literary editor of The Sunday Times. Thank you so much for talking to me. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Christy Evans and David Stevens. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.